Welcome to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Calabrese, former CPG founder turned executive who finally woke up one day, 16 years into my career, and decided to take back my power and build a community for women in CPG. Tune in as we break down strategies that successful female entrepreneurs are using to build their businesses and talk about what it's like to be a woman in a male-dominated industry. You'll hear stories of the people who make shit happen, overcoming struggles, and celebrating the wins. Whether you're looking for inspiration, industry secrets, or life-changing insights, this is the place. Today, we're diving into the world of non-alcoholic beverages with a true pioneer in the space, Melanie Masserin, founder of Gia. Launched in 2020, Gia has redefined what it means to drink socially, proving that a night out or in doesn't need alcohol to be sophisticated, flavorful, and fun. Inspired by Mediterranean aperitif culture, Melanie set out to create a booze-free option that still delivers the complexity, ritual, and experience of a great cocktail without the hangover. In this episode, we're going to chat about Melanie's journey from working at Glossier to launching one of the most design-forward, disruptive brands in the beverage industry today. We'll get into the challenges that she faced building a category-defining product, scaling a business in the competitive food and beverage space, and where the future lies for non-alcoholic drinks. So whether you're an entrepreneur, a brand builder, or just love a beautifully crafted drink, this conversation is packed with insights you won't want to miss. Let's dive in. Melanie, welcome to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast.
Hi.
I'm so happy to have you here today. You are such an inspiration for so many people in this industry and so many women in this industry. I'm excited to dive in with you and chat.
I'm so excited. Finally, it's happening. Breakfast in LA a few months ago.
I know. More than a few months ago. That was like that was like at least 6 months ago. So anyway, I want to start off with a question that I ask all my guests. What are you currently hustling for, Melanie?
So many things. We just kicked off a fundraise and we just launched at Whole Foods. So you can imagine that there's a lot going on internally right now.
Yes. Yeah, totally. And I want to get into the Whole Foods conversation as well too, because last time we spoke, it was a different conversation. So I'm excited to hear more about that. So first, before we dive in, I want to just give a little bit, I want to go through your timeline because I love your background and your experience. It's super eclectic and, you know, you've been busy the last 13 years. So here we go. 2011, you graduated from Brown University with a BA in economics. 2012 to 2013, you were a financial analyst at Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. From 2014 to 2015, you moved into the food industry, serving as head of marketing and creative director at Diggin. Mm-hmm. 2016 to 2017, you were with Glossier as head of retail and offline experiences. 2019, you were in Forbes 30 Under 30, which is so fun and amazing. 2020, you got into Gia. You founded Gia, a non-alcoholic inspired brand by Mediterranean aperitivo culture. And then in 2020, you appeared on Shark Tank, which is a whole other thing that hopefully we have enough time to talk about. And that really brought a lot of attention to your brand. So that's such an amazing timeline. How did your background in retail with Glossier and Diggin, how did that lead you to Gia?
Well, wow. It's so funny when you hear it like this, it's like all the things that, you know, led to making Gia. You think you have a plan and then you realize that it never goes according to plan. But in hindsight, it sort of all made sense as something that brought me here. And, you know, I think that with Glossier, the company, and Emily, the founder of Glossier, were so focused on the customer and making the customer happy and being obsessed with their customer. That was my big learning from there. I mean, there were many learnings, but with Gia, I think that that's really something that we've sort of like taken. And we're always thinking, you know, our customer is the hero, the product's not the hero. How are we just a catalyst for the customer to have a nice time? And I think that that's done a lot for our brand. But, you know, I really enjoyed my time at Goldman. It just wasn't for me. I think that I'm like a secretly creative person who just happened to be good at math. And so was always, my parents were like, you know, my parents didn't graduate high school and like they did fine, but it was a different time. So they were like, we have this kid who's really good at math. Like, let's have her do math. And I was totally miserable in school growing up and, you know, went to Brown sort of like to escape. Yeah. I loved my time at Brown, but throughout, my family was always cooking, you know. I think in France we're just my family especially, but we were always cooking. I think by the time I got to Brown, I'd probably gone to eat out at a restaurant like 10 times in my life, which is just about how many times people go out to a restaurant in New York City in a week. And so and I got here and I realized no one cooks. And so it sort of became my language of love. And I think there was always this idea of like, you don't need much to be generous. You know, my grandmother was a huge inspiration for me. She was my favorite person in the world. And like, I was her favorite person in the world, I think, or at least that's how I felt like her love. And she was, you know, had very few means, but whenever you got to her kitchen or whenever you got to her dining room, you felt like the most special person in the world. And she had that gift. And I think that we're really trying to make people feel like that with Gia. It's like it's a lot of making people feel included, making people feel like they're part of the party. The alcohol is not the life of the party. You're the life of the party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that so much. So you have had some awesome press recently. I just listened to a fireside chat that you did with Jen from the founder of Kin at South by Southwest. I feel like that must have been like last week, right? Like it's very recent.
It was last weekend. It was 4 days ago.
It's all one continuum. Totally. So I listened to that and there was a couple of things that you guys touched on that I loved that I wanted to chat a little further about with you. So the story that you guys told about Target and how you insisted on Kin working with you to build out the category. So for anyone who doesn't know this story, Target came to Melanie, to Gia, and said, we're ready for Gia. And you came back and said, well, Gia's not quite ready for Target yet. And you were very nervous about the fact that you were going to be the first on shelf at Target within your category. When you came back to Target and told them, we would consider it if you brought in these other brands, specifically Kin. And I think it's such a interesting lesson on for other brands on how truly important it is to link arms if you're pioneering new categories, new products, and you have this huge task of educating the consumer on what your product is. So can you like expand on that a little bit for us, Melanie? And I think for the listeners and the other founders out there about how linking arms with these other brands has really just opened up so many doors, not only for Gia, but for the category as a whole and the awareness as a whole.
Yeah. You know, I think that we were lucky to get an introduction to Target very early days because one of our investors, we have a lot of angel investors who are entrepreneurs. One of our investors is one of those like Target whisperers who has built like multi-billion dollar companies on products that are very successful at Target. And so he sort of put us in front of them, which is very intimidating for us, especially coming out of COVID. You know, we launched in the pandemic. I'm sure we'll talk about that. And, our entire business was built on the Shopee shops. You know, the first 400 Gia accounts, I DM'd on Instagram myself because I was like, please take us on. I know it's really early. I know it's 2020. No one's taking on new products, but I've been working on this for the past 2 years and it's the most important thing for me and the product's amazing. Please take us on. And a lot of the Shopee shops, you know, they do their buying very independently. You don't have to jump through so many loops and they were willing to give it a try. They love novelty. But when, you know, Target was very interested in this category, they're incredible innovators as a retailer. Mm-hmm. They, you know, love to take risks and to try new things. And so we thought, okay, there's two things. Like one, we need to share some foot traffic. We need to bring foot traffic. We're a very small brand. We don't have the power to bring foot traffic to, I think at the beginning, it was like 400 stores in Target. But there are other brands in the category that have a quality product, that have a devout following too. And we think we should bring them in. And two, we need to contextualize the category because if you have a can of Gia in a premium beverage fridge that is next to nitro cold brew and kombucha and I don't know, whatever else. And everyone has these like 8 to 12 ounce cans next to like an Olipop or even next to Arizona tea, right? It's like, what the hell is ghee? You know, you don't know that it's for evening. You don't know that it's like an aperitivo. You don't know it's going to be dry. You're going to crack it open because maybe you've decided you're going to get the most expensive can in that fridge. And you're going to crack it open and be like, what is that? It's so bitter. Like, when am I supposed to drink this? But what we pitched to Target is, let's do a dry January non-alcoholic aisle. And we actually introduced them to Sechet, which is a non-alcoholic bottle shop in the South, founded by this woman, Emily. And we knew Kin and Gia were some of their top brands. And so I said, let's make a selection. Let's bring in Kin. Let's bring in other people. And Emily did all of the curation for Target for the past year and a half. She did an amazing job, helped with signage, navigating this big retailers for all the brand. And so I think it was just a better way to sort of bring people, because suddenly you have 10 brands that are talking about, you know, we're in a sprint, and some people are talking about not drinking more directly. And then some people are talking about we have like mingle mocktails and, you know, non-alcoholic palomas and things like that. And suddenly it makes sense. You know, the context is so helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Partnerships are just so amazing. Like linking arms with other brands. I love that as a strategy, like as a whole, it can like really accelerate your visibility. Yeah. I think it's a great strategy. So you also mentioned in this interview, in the South by interview with Jen from the founder of Kin, you mentioned, you guys were talking about some of the mistakes that you made at the beginning that, you know, were lessons that you had learned. And you had mentioned that you didn't build the right margin from the beginning. You were talking about pricing for longevity versus the race to the bottom and how other brands in the category have been coming in, pricing themselves like $2 lower per case than you. So what were some of those things? Pricing is such a hot topic with early stage founders. Getting that right is absolutely crucial. So can you just be more specific for anybody listening out there, like what you would have done differently?
It's tricky. I think in retrospect, I wouldn't have done anything differently because there are really two main factors that are affecting how you set pricing. It's easy to think, these are my costs. This is the margin that I need to make. So this is the price. But when you're a newcomer in a new category, you have to think about the willingness to pay of your customer. And what we learned really early on is because there's no buzz to our product, like there's no functional effect.
Right.
We're not making people drunk, quite literally. People assign a lesser value to our product in a way. And so you're looking at the price for on-premise, you're looking at the price on shelves, you're looking at the price on your site. And, you know, we're like, okay, if we make 30 at the time, the price for the bottle was $33 and we only had the bottle. And, you know, the year later, we had to bring the price up for a single bottle to $38. Mm-hmm. And it was painful. Our customers were very supportive, but it was also at a time in COVID when the freights got very expensive. Aluminum prices were at an all-time high. It was just like everything, right? And it wasn't like we were getting 3% increases on things. It was like 30%, 40%. Oh, yeah. And so it was in a way that we couldn't have anticipated, and we definitely couldn't have passed it on to our customers. But like, people don't understand, like, we now have very serious volume at Gia, and we're still not profitable because the costs of doing business is just really high. There's like a very high barrier to entry. It takes scale for these, you know, companies to make money. I don't think that customers often understand that. Like this morning, you know, it was announced that Poppy is being acquired by Pepsi.
I saw that.
Instagram. I mean, good for them, honestly. Slay. But I was looking at the Instagram comments and people were like, why are these brands selling out? I'm like, I don't think you understand what it takes and how good it is if suddenly you have a partner that's like handling your distribution, handling your manufacturing. You know, it doesn't always mean they're going to change the formula. And so for us, like, because we don't have this scale, we do everything ourselves. We can't negotiate as much with the can suppliers, the co-packers, everything. It's hard. But from the beginning, I think we were really focused on the customer. That was and a bit to a fault where, you know, we never charge for shipping. It's like, why do you eat 100% of the shipping cost every time, you know? And we had some learnings. And so we always tried to kind of like try that line where it's fair for everyone. But it's really hard.
It is. And I think that what, you know, the thing that's often overlooked, especially with in beverage too, is like you might be making, call it, I don't know your unit economics. You might make, I'm making this up, 50 cents a can or 25 cents a can. And you're like, great, we're making 25 cents a can. But what we forget about is you have marketing expenses, you have sales expenses, you have overhead expenses, and don't forget, you have to make that next can. right? And that next can costs you more, most likely more than the profit that you just made off that last can that you sold.
Yeah.
So that's why this category specifically is like so thirsty for cash. I always like to say beverage. I feel like beverage is like, it's just so thirsty for cash. Because the margins are so slim, because the price points are so low, you know, that's interesting. I, you know, thank you for like breaking down your, you know, the pricing and everything. Did you know that 70 to 80% of CPG brands fail within the first year? Yikes. Because they lack a strategic go-to-market plan, they start without enough funding, or they don't have a clear path to sustainable growth. We've got you covered though. So in Launch Lab, you'll learn how to launch, grow, and scale your brand the right way. We'll give you a step-by-step roadmap, insider strategies for success, marketing and sales playbook, funding and financial guidance. So this is for you if you're a first-time food and beverage CPG founder, you have an idea for a brand and you need a playbook, you're in the early stages and you haven't yet nailed your go-to-market strategy, or you want to expand, you're navigating farmers markets or Shopify and want to venture into retail. Maybe you're developing your product and you're delving into formulation or contemplating a retail entrance. You need strategic guidance. You can be operational, but you're still seeking to refine your go-to-market strategy. Launch Lab Masterclass March, April, May session is sold out. But not to worry, we're launching another session in September. We kick off that first week of September. So go to the show notes and sign up to be on the wait list to get notifications about when early registration opens up. Trust me, if you are doing this for the first time, this is an educational session you absolutely do not want to miss. So you and I had coffee towards the end of last year, and I think it was around September or so, and you were frustrated because Whole Foods hadn't given you guys attention yet. And, you know, we talked a lot about this. And then literally 6 or 8 weeks later, I see on your Instagram that you're rolling out Whole Foods. And I was like, oh, wow, something obviously like just clicked and changed. Talk to us about Whole Foods and like finally, what was that unlock? Like how did that all come down?
You know, it's so funny because Whole Foods has this portal and everything has to happen through the portal. And for 2 years, we've been trying to get in touch with people at Whole Foods. It'd be like figuring out the right person on LinkedIn. And like, you know, our buyer is called Melanie. So it's funny because at the team, they're like, the other Melanie isn't answering Melanie. And, you know, I was just like, the next possible phase of growth for us has to come from Whole Foods. You know, they've built the sort of like good produce for everyone. They have 500 stores throughout the country. They're the most mindful in terms of ingredients. And a lot of our competitors were going to Sprouts. And we just felt like we weren't ready for Sprouts and we really wanted Whole Foods. So we held back on submitting our product for Sprouts. And then I think that when we met, you know, our CEO, Joy, had just joined the company. So yeah, it was probably like the end of the summer. And we heard back in September, October, we got an email that our product was accepted in 120 licensed stores in Whole Foods, which means the ones that sell alcohol. And shortly after that, we got told that we got a great promo at Whole Foods, which is basically when they give you marketing and they give you specific placement in the store, a double promo, which is January, February, and then March and April, which is like so exciting for us. And so we actually, you know, we were doing the strategic planning for the year and we pivoted our entire strategy. We like tightened our belt to make it work, to really deliver because January to April, we're in 400 stores at Whole Foods, which is so, so amazing for us. And, I don't know. It was like a dream come true, truly. So it was like suddenly we're like, you know, everyone on the team is doing a demo at Whole Foods quarterly. Like I went to the Lamar store in Austin and I wanted to meet the customer, you know? And so I was, you know, the girl in the produce aisle being like, have you tried Gia? Do you know Gia? And everyone's like, no. I'm like, damn, we have so much work to do. But it was
totally, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. But it was so great. And so Whole Foods, we've gotten a lot of love from Whole Foods since that breakfast. And I think we have given a lot of our, you know, attention and effort and resources to Whole Foods. And we're so excited.
Yeah. I saw you guys at the Pasadena location last week when I was there and I was very happy to see that. So when you first launched, you thought you were launching in on-premise in restaurants and oops, pandemic right at your launch, like worst time, couldn't have been worse timing for you because you had to totally pivot your strategy. So how has your channel strategy changed from like what you thought it was going to be on day one, what it like turned into and what it is now? Like, talk to us about your channel strategy and like where you're selling, how you're selling, alcohol distribution, because I feel like that's something that people like don't realize about your brand as well too.
Yeah. So we, you know, I was like, I'm making this great drink and I know nothing about beverage, but if make it, then they will come. Right. And I thought, okay, people are asking me what even is a non-alcoholic drink and what even is sort of like non-alcoholic spirit. So I was like, we need to build legitimacy. We also, I really wanted to build a super inclusive brand. So for me, if you're telling people it's okay not to drink, but you have to order this bottle at home and make your cocktail at home and stay home to drink it, you're not completing the mission. You're not fully inclusive. So it's really important to me to be like, you have to have it in venues. You have to have it, you know, in concert venues, which those have been really hard to crack and whatnot. And so, you know, trying to introduce this product to the culinary world and build legitimacy. And so we'd locked like 50 amazing restaurants, which was really hard to do. So like we're talking like that's like 2019. And we're supposed to launch on April 1st, 2020. And 2 weeks before all the restaurants shut down. It's just like, oh no, well now we're launching online basically. No one knew how long the pandemic would last. Obviously hindsight is 2020, but so we launched, you know, with the Shopee shops and online. And then it just, I think, delayed a little bit of the momentum for this category because on the one hand, I think everybody was drinking themselves into oblivion at the beginning of 2020 and then was stuck to their phone. So there was a lot of attention. People were like, this is interesting because if we continue like this, we are all going to die very young. But at the same time, the product just wasn't available anywhere that people were shopping.
Right.
So as I said, it was just DMing Shopee shops on Instagram. And that's how we signed the first 400 accounts, which is so crazy. But it definitely delayed, you know, distributors giving attention to the category. And those are things that accelerated a little bit later. And, you know, we were the past year and a half, we have sort of been rebuilding our channel mix. But interestingly, because we launched online and because consumer habits changed because of the pandemic, you know, Amazon has become the grocery store of the internet, for instance. And so our sales today are still 50-50 online and offline, which is very unusual for a company now of our size. But Amazon has sort of become a sort of like replenishment establishment because people don't love to carry a lot of drinks home. It delivers straight to your door in such a short amount of time. And then we still have core, you know, loyalists. The pricing is just better on our website if you buy a big bundle. And so we don't create, you know, arbitrage for pricing on the small packs, but it just for us, we try to also, we hear from customers a lot. We want to have the stock at all times and the product's expensive. And pricing has just been such a thing throughout, right? It's a common thread. It's like, you don't want it to be a hurdle for customers, but your product is premium and you don't want to devalue how premium your product is. And so for us, we're just trying to make sure that the people that want to have it can have it. So if you buy a 108 pack, the product lasts a year, you know, and like, you want to keep it, you want to share it, you want to have a party, you want to have it at your wedding, like that pack's almost 30% off on our site. And so we're able to pass that on to you because if we sell on Amazon, they take 30%. And by the way, like we love Amazon. I sometimes order on Amazon because I'm like, I'm having a party, I don't have Gia. And sometimes that bottle shows up at my door in 6 hours. Like it's incredible, right? You know, but it's just different use cases.
So for people who are new to beverage or this industry, why did you decide to go alcohol distribution versus non-alc? Why are you working with alcohol distributors?
They go to the places we want to be served and we want to be where people are drinking alcohol. So if it's tough because these distributors have an order minimum, right? So we could go with really incredible niche, you know, fine foods or snacks distributors that are going to the fancy coffee shops and whatnot. But if the fancy coffee shop, you know, is ordering just Gia, they don't make their order minimum. You want to basically go, or the restaurant is ordering just from that, you know, fine food producer, they might not make their minimum. And so you want to be in a place where they're ordering several things from the same distributor so that they can make that minimum and they're serving the accounts that you want. So for instance, in New York, we're actually not allowed to be sold in liquor stores. That's just a New York alcohol law. And so we're allowed to be sold alongside beer and wine. So we are with a beer distributor. But you know, when we launched in California first or in a lot of The South, you know, we do very well in premium wine stores or in restaurants. And so we do better with what we call DSDs, which are more high touch, smaller distributors that also are wine importers or things like that.
Yeah. I think it's just alcohol distribution is so hard, right? It can be really difficult to break into.
Very difficult.
I think if, you know, you don't have to go that route, you should question if you should, but you know, an amazing point. You want to be playing in that space and there's no other way to do it, really. So the alcohol category as the industry as a whole is a $320 billion industry, which is crazy. I was just looking that up this morning, $320 billion. And you are carving out this subcategory of NA drinks. A couple of years ago, I got educated on the alcohol industry because I was running a company that was launching an alcoholic beverage, an alcoholic line extension. And the investors really wanted me to be educated on alcohol distribution. So we brought in a consultant and I was lucky enough to be able to learn from him. He had been in the industry for more than 35 years. And when we were building, you know, the company ended up not launching the alcoholic line, but I went on to start my consulting business and I called him when I had a non-alcoholic wine client that came to me that wanted help. I was talking to him about the launch and just the NA category as a whole. And he's been in this industry for almost 40 years. He just fundamentally doesn't understand why you would want have a drink without alcohol. Doesn't understand it. Like it's really difficult for him as someone who's been in this industry for so long, right? I thought that was interesting for me because it made me think of you and just the category as a whole. There's so many people in this industry like him that just don't get it, right? That run the alcohol sales and distribution world. And you, if you're on those same trucks, you have to play with those people and, you know, go up against that like resistance. So what is that like? Like getting into such a massive industry that doesn't fully get what you're doing. You know, I mean,
there's the industry and there's my parents.
Like, right. Exactly. Let me just like clarify that. Obviously there is tons of people that understand what you're doing, of course, especially younger generations. Right. But there's also so many people who just don't get it. What is that like?
You know, it's hard, but you get out of bed for the people that do get it. When I had the idea, you know, I remember I'm joking that my parents are one of them, but I have parents who are, you know, they live in the south of France. They have aperitivo once, sometimes twice a day. And when I told them, like, I'm thinking of doing this, you know, and every time I go to France, my dad's like, are you still not drinking, you know? And like, they're supportive in general, but they don't really understand it.
Yeah.
And they were kind of like, why? Why are people going to buy it if it doesn't have alcohol in it? So is it juice? They couldn't wrap their head around it. Mm-hmm. And my little brother, who is usually a bit more of a contrarian with me and was 26 years old at the time, immediately said, I would drink that. And I was like, why? Like, you would drink that? And he said, yes, I go out all the time. And I have school in the morning or I have work in the morning and I drive a scooter and the only thing that I can drink is Red Bull and it keeps me up all night. And I thought that was quite interesting because he didn't have to be explained it too much. Mm-hmm. But, you know, interestingly, it's been 5 years now, 6 years, 7 years maybe since that conversation with them. And when I went home for the holidays, my dad said, did you bring the green cans? I like them and I'm trying to do 200 days without drinking this year, as if it was like the biggest accomplishment. Mm-hmm. But so I thought, oh, okay. So they even got my dad now and my parents both did dry January this year. So I think that, you know, every year we have to decondition people from decades of alcohol marketing and billions of dollars of alcohol marketing. And like, that's hard to do and I can't do it alone. And that's why we have like amazing other founders, like, you know, Jen from Kin. I really admire her because, well, with Gia, we never talk about not drinking. We don't like to talk about it. We're just here if you decide not to. But if every time we host an event, there's alcohol, there's no alcohol. Like we're very much like everybody does whatever they want. Right. I really admire Jen because she was the first to be like, alcohol's bad for you. And here are other ways that you can feel, you know, levity or all of these other things. And so she has really opened the conversation around sort of like what these things do to your body. And now obviously the research is showing it finally, like the you know, Surgeon General's warning about alcohol. And like, finally, it's proven that no, a glass of red wine every day is not good for you, and that there's no amount of alcohol that's good for you, and that it does mess with your sleep and all of these things. So there's obviously tailwinds, you know?
Yeah, totally. I know. I mean, so much information came out this year about that, right? Like, and I'll bet you had your biggest January ever this year because of all of the Surgeon General's warning. I think that, wouldn't that come out on like on the first or the second or something?
I don't remember if it was early in the year or like late last year, but yes, I mean, we are out of stock of Le Fizz because at some point in January, we realized we just couldn't make it fast enough. And we've just been out of stock for the full months because we sold what we thought of Le Fizz we were going to sell this quarter. Which is a good problem to have, but also, as you know, extremely annoying.
Well, there's lots of demand, so you're doing something right. So where is Gia headed? What do the next 5 years look like? Talk to us about that.
Well, we are going to keep bringing more people into our brand. I hope we're going to, you know, expand our distribution. Like right now, we're not even in Florida. We have a few restaurant accounts in Florida, but we serve them directly. Kehi takes us to the account, to the targets, you know, in Florida that we're in, but we have very little distribution in Florida. And so we're going to, you know, expand our distribution. We also want to go deeper in the states that we're already in. So we're distributed in 30 something states now. And like, you know, it's a constant battle to get on restaurant menus and make sure we're in as many places as possible because these things change really quickly. I mean, I just moved to New York City and like the top 10 restaurants are not the same top 10 that were the top 10 when I was living here 5 years ago. And so we want to be on those menus. We want to be where the customer is. We're going to do a limited edition flavor very soon, which I'm very excited about. And yeah, those are really fun. But you know, every time you launch a flavor, you also have to convince retailers to take you on. And we already have a number of SKUs. So much of it is also educating people about our product while also delighting the ones that have been with us since the beginning. You know, I think that we are, hopefully our dream would be to go national at Whole Foods. So if anyone listening here lives next to a Whole Foods and is CG at Whole Foods, please buy it so that they can keep us and expand, you know, the territory at Whole Foods. And I would love to get Le Fizz, our newest product, into a national retailer as well, because it's been doing incredibly well. It's sort of removing the hurdle of having to make a cocktail, but it's a more, you know, generous and shareable format than an individual can. And it's better value as well.
Yeah.
So Le Fizz has been a killer, and it's $20 price point, which was really hard to do. And we really wanted, in retrospect, we should have charged $25 for it. But you see the story here, you know, it's like a good bottle of wine, and we wanted it to be very approachable. So it's doing super well. And I would love to see that product at a Whole Foods, or, you know, maybe we will go after Sprouts. I don't know. They're also not answering our emails, but hopefully.
Right. My gosh. So, okay. Couple of rapid fire questions for you. What is one thing that you wish more people knew about starting a beverage brand?
It's very hard. You can't raise money until you absolutely have to. Because it's a very capital intensive business. And if I were to speak to aspiring beverage founders, it's like, you're just going to end up owning less of your business than what you wish. So save it, hoard that equity until you can no longer.
Hold off on fundraising as long as possible. Yep. So what is a business or a brand that inspires you? What are you looking at? I want to know that. Where do you look for inspo?
I look in the past a lot in terms of design references and things like that. Like, I'm actually like not that interested in anything that anyone currently is doing. And everything that I think about is how we can be different. But you know, I think that definitely every product we design like stemmed from a memory. So it's the memory of a feeling is pretty much, you know, when we started on Nutella, it was the memory of our feeling of my parents going out. It was always this idea of going out and the preparation and the transition. So Gia is a transition drink. It takes you from work into play. It takes you to the coast of Italy. It takes you places. Like, so we always, there's a lot around travel, but it can be internal travel. It can be spiritual travel. It can be so many things. And so when we developed, for instance, our little, you know, new Nutella, it was about remembering when my parents were going out, my mom would get dressed up and, you know, they would let us make stacks of crepes and we would slather Nutella on top. And so that was kind of the idea for this holiday product. And, you know, we're like our next product, we're talking about like a tropical vacation and just sort of like having flavors that you wouldn't have otherwise that maybe aren't quite Mediterranean, but make you feel like you're very unplugged. So it's like this flavor of being very unplugged. And then there's, you know, we're developing a flavor, where we still have a lot of work to do for it to taste right, but that I'm personally very excited about because it's the flavor for me of home. So It's a flavor. My parents live in Provence and there's a lot of amazing flowers in Provence. And every time I go home, like I go on these long bike rides with my brother in the morning because I'm working on US hours. So I have the mornings free and there's fields of lavender and there's like fields of amazing flowers. So it's hard to make it not taste like perfume, but we want like ever slightly floral on top of just like the spritz flavor. So we're working on something like that. That will be like my spritz of my parents' home.
Can't wait. That sounds amazing. So, okay, last question. What do you love about running your business and what do you really dislike? I love hearing this from founders. Like why do you get up in the morning and what are the things that you just absolutely wish you didn't have to deal with?
You know, I think that running Gia is my dream job. But I wish I could do it 40% less. Like I work 40 hours a day and it's so brutal. And I always say it takes so many computer hours to sell the spritz life. Yeah. And it's like, you know, like I would just love to work from like 9 to 5 instead of, you know, really, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, I'll do like 8 to 7 and I'll take a break and then I'll start again and I'll work until midnight, like most nights of the week, you know, it's not fun right now. And that's difficult.
Yeah. I know that's the founder burnout is real for sure. But what do you do to take care of yourself? I mean, what do you do to counter that?
You know, I try to do a few things very consistently. Like I try to get my butt to the gym 3 times a week because 5 is impossible. Honestly, 3 is hard because New York City, you have to deal with the workout wait list, which is a whole thing. And you know, I try
know
to,
about that. That's interesting.
No, it's beyond. Like I miss, you know, I miss being like, I'm going to go to Silver Springs in LA on Saturday morning. And even that had gotten a little crazy with the waitlist, but in New York, it's pretty mental. Like I'm having a hard time with just getting into Pilates classes because it just doesn't jive with my workouts, you know, with my work schedule. But so anyways, maybe I'll just end up doing stuff at home. And, you know, I love to indulge when I eat out because I always want food to be fun for me. And I was questions when I started this company is it still going to bring me joy and be fun for me if this is my work? But I try to indulge when I go out, but I also try to be like very mindful of what I eat for lunch. So I'm not super tired in the afternoon and just stay healthy in general.
Yeah. Well, I love this. Thank you for chatting with us and giving us a peek behind the curtain on all the awesome things that you're working on and the distribution and sales and growth of Gia. You're so awesome. I just love watching Gia grow and I love watching you as the founder grow with it. So kudos to you, babe.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, of course.
You're the best.
Thanks, Melanie.
If you liked what you heard, it would mean so much if you follow and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. For tips and advice on your food and beverage CPG brand, you can find us on Instagram at itsallhappeningco or visit our website at itsallhappeningagency.co to be the first to hear about workshops, courses, and in-person events and freebies. Until next week.